This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There are some amazing young people with amazing young minds attending school all over the country. And for some reason, they're just plain bad at being students.
As I tell the students I work with today, that I had to get a D before I could get a PhD.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a veteran educator about what it takes to develop the skills that help a student learn how to learn. Then we'll meet a refugee family who live in central New York, who are going to school and building a family in a town that makes them feel welcome. And we'll spend an academic minute with politicians and the media, because no one ever talks about that, right? I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Sometimes being smart just isn't good enough. According to Carrie Green, without motivation and the proper learning skills, even the most successful elementary student can encounter big trouble as they move on to higher education. He outlines those skills and how to perfect them in his new book, Success Skills for High School, College, and Career. Dr. Carrie J. Green spent 20 years as an educator and school administrator before striking out on his own to motivate students to succeed. I asked him where the idea for this book came from.
It all started years ago when I was a college student. I did quite well in high school, and I got to the university, and I nearly flunked out of my first chemistry class. And that was quite a shock. I thought I didn't understand chemistry, but it turns out I really didn't understand how to study, so I lacked the success skills that I needed. And I've seen over the years, as I was a faculty member for 20 years, I saw a lot of young students who I thought were pretty intelligent, but they weren't really performing at the level of their ability. And it hit me that it seems to be a skills deficit as much as anything else. And there's a gap between our performance and our ability sometimes. And I think the key is removing the limitations that are within our control. So if we can develop our skill set, that allows us to perform at the level of our ability. And as I said, my score in chemistry was pretty bad until I got my academic success skills figured out, and I was able to take the course again and do quite well and ultimately earn a PhD. And as I tell the students I work with today, that I had to get a D before I could get a PhD.
Okay. I hear that a lot from parents more than anyone else, but from teachers too, that, you know, this kid is brilliant. He's just a terrible student.
Yeah. And there's a difference between not being able to do something and not knowing how to do something. And I'll use a very simple example of riding a bike. Before we learned how to ride a bike, we had the intelligence to ride a bike. We just didn't know how to ride a bike. And I think the same thing is true with a lot of areas in life, and certainly in academics. As I said, I thought my performance in chemistry was solely due to my understanding of chemistry, but the underlying issue was the lack of skills. And I think, again, that is true for many students in many aspects of life. If oftentimes we look at using the case of students, we look at the individual course and think, gee whiz, this is hard or I can't do this. But really, if we dig down and work hard and work smart, we often can accomplish much more than we think we can. And in my case, it took me about flunking out of college to figure that out.
Well, when you're an 18-year-old heading into college, do you really have the self-awareness to know that you need a plan?
I have commented, and it's only part jokingly, that we should teach freshman seminar to sophomores, because sometimes as a freshman, we don't know what we don't know, and it's not until we get in there and find out that those classes are pretty tough and find out that we don't know quite what we thought we did, then once that happens, let's say we're more likely to learn. So I think that self-awareness is huge. I think the ability to understand ourselves, our strengths, and our weaknesses, and not only understand those, but be able to fix the weaknesses that we can and also align our efforts with our strengths, I think that's very, very important to success. But I think you're absolutely right. And it's hard to see what we're capable of if we've not really been challenged. And as I said, college challenged me quite a bit. I was able to figure it out, but it wasn't until I made a mistake.
Part of what you write about in the book, and one of the exercises you actually give in the book, is to watch two people debate and just kind of, you know, maybe a subject you know, maybe a subject you don't know, and come down on one side or the other and then try to describe why. Talk about that.
Well, you're talking about, of course, our critical thinking discussion. And oftentimes, I think when we, or I'll speak for myself, speak for a lot of students I worked with over the years, we often think about learning in terms of being able to memorize something. I can, you know, cram for this test, or I can remember these facts and figures and I'll be all right. And that's not too bad in the early years, but as we move into college and graduate school and into life, we really need to be able to think and be able to think independently and be able to separate fact from opinion. And that involves evaluating our own biases and our own assumptions. We need to ask questions, and of course we need to evaluate evidence. And that example that you're referring to is something that a student could simply do by watching a debate on television. And they may not be an expert in the area, but I think with a little practice they'll be able to figure out when somebody's making a statement that's kind of their opinion versus a statement that's based on fact. And certainly informed opinion is very important, don't get me wrong, but when it gets right down to it, the ability to think on your own, draw your own conclusions based on the information that's available to you, that is a very important skill for young people to develop.
You devote an entire chapter in your book to the importance of being a good communicator and learning how to communicate. How is communication important to being a learner?
Well, I think the first thing is being a good listener. Consider a student that's sitting in class listening to a lecture. It's quite easy for our minds to drift, but a good communicator is a good listener. So I think the way communication can help a student and help learning, of course, is being able to listen, not only in class, but listen to your faculty when you go to office hours and those kind of things. Because I know over the years I've explained stuff to students, and sometimes I think they just weren't listening. Other times I think they were listening, but they didn't get it. But there's a difference between listening and not getting it, and not getting it because you're not listening. So the first thing, I think, of course, is to focus on listening to be a good learner. The next thing, of course, is being able to articulate your ideas. If you have the best idea in the world, but you can't get that information across, if you can't share that intelligently with other people, that information is really of no use. And I think about a student writing an answer to an essay question or a short answer question on an exam. The ability to articulate clearly the answer to that question is very, very important. So having the knowledge, of course, is the first step, but being able to communicate it such that others can understand and get to the point, as I talked about in critical thinking, it's very important to be able to develop an argument to support your case. So in the case of learning, it's, of course, drawing on the knowledge and synthesizing the information you have to come up to the answers to the questions on your exams and certainly be able to articulate those appropriately. And then you get out of school, of course, and now it's no longer a written exam, but it's life coming at you where you need to synthesize information, be able to draw conclusions, and then communicate those with others.
You were, of course, for years a teacher and a part of the school system. Now you're on the outside. What can you do on the outside that you couldn't do when you were on the inside?
Well, I think I can devote 100% of my time to working on success skills development for young folks, and that's very important for me. I think this is a big puzzle, a big issue, and we all have a piece. I think certainly being inside higher education, being in the classroom is absolutely important. And the same thing for advisors and being able to work with students, and everybody who comes in contact with a student can help that student along. In fact, I'm reminded of a story of several years ago. I had a discussion with students and asked them who was the most important person in their life or who had the greatest influence on their academic success. And we hear parents and teachers and that kind of thing, but one of the students commented that it was her supervisor for her on-campus position, and this person wasn't a faculty member, it wasn't a teacher, but he had a tremendous impact on this young person because he took the time to listen, he mentored her, he helped her make some decisions, and ultimately she worked out. Ultimately, she was successful in school. But the main thing for me being outside now is I can dedicate my time 100% to working with young people on these success skills.
are there things in the school systems now that make it difficult while being in the inside to help students like that? I'm thinking of your standardized testing and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, if you think about coming from a higher education background, I think there are a lot of things competing for faculty time. If they're at a research-intensive university, certainly there's research to do. There's also a deeper issue that I found, and that is teaching my subject matter, which certainly was important to me. And when I started teaching, that was my main focus. If I could teach the students the science of our discipline, then I felt I was doing good. But as I transitioned through my career and up until the point that I left, I kind of changed my philosophy to the point of trying to really emphasize these success skills. And I think there's a lot of folks trying to do that, but it's somewhat difficult to cover all the material. But my point is, you can have standalone courses on critical thinking, and those are important, don't get me wrong, but incorporating the critical thinking skills into a course is important. Have the student work within the context of their discipline. Certainly the communication skills, getting the writing and the speaking into the curriculum is very, very important. And there are a lot of folks doing that, but again, sometimes it can be difficult, especially if the faculty and teachers are not necessarily experts or really up on that. It takes some extra time and effort, but it's very important, and I think a lot of schools are moving that way as they recognize the importance of these skills.
Still to come, our conversation with Kerry Green continues with a look at some basic advice for students and teachers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Kerry J. Green, a veteran educator and the author of the new book, Success Skills for High School, College, and Career. I asked Dr. Green what's the most important message he has for students and teachers.
What I would tell a student is attitude is probably the number one factor that I've seen influencing success. And what I mean by that is a student who has the right attitude is willing to develop the skills they need. They're willing to put in the time they need. They're willing to give their best effort. And they're willing, if they make a mistake or have a trouble with a class, they're willing to get help. And that is so, so, so important. And I think sometimes it's easy to kind of hit the brick wall. And again, I'll go back to my example of the chemistry class. I considered dropping out of school. I thought, hey, you know, I tried this. It didn't work out that well in this class. Maybe college isn't for me. And I could have easily dropped out and tried to do something else. But fortunately, I had the fortitude to try again, and I learned that I could do it if I put forth the right effort. And having that attitude, it's not being arrogant. You got to balance your belief in yourself with your humility and be able to ask for help and realize you don't know everything. But to me, an attitude of success, an attitude of I can do it is very, very important because that integrates and empowers all the other things that underlie success. As far as a teacher goes, my advice to a teacher is obviously do the best you can and meet these students where they're at and try to incorporate these soft skills, these success skills into your coursework as best you can. And the critical thinking exercises and the communication exercises are very, very important. It takes extra time and it takes extra work, but it's certainly well worth the investment.
Finally, how do these academic skills and methods convert into a career for a student?
Well, a lot of the academic success skills that are needed also are the so-called soft skills. For example, time management is very, very important for a student. It's also very, very important for somebody starting a new job, and it's certainly important as you move up the chain of command. So there is a lot of overlap. Good communication skills, as we've discussed earlier, time management, work ethic, critical thinking. A lot of these skills that are important in the working world or important in life in general are also very important for students. And being able to read and prepare for a test, they may not be preparing for a written test when they get on the job, but certainly the skills they have of pulling information together, synthesizing information, and being able to respond to questions and address problems. And so the students develop those skills, then those skills transfer into their career. And that's why I like the integration of the academic success skills and the soft skills, because many of them overlap and are identical or very similar. I guess another thing that I'd like to share with young people, and you'll know this too just from your life experience, that it's okay to fail. It's okay to take a class and not do that well in it. If you've done your best, then that's the best you can do. But if you fail, it doesn't mean you can't do it. This is the most important thing. An initial fail does not mean that you're not capable of doing that. And don't give up. Now, sometimes a student will work very hard and they will not be able to get through a particular class. If that's the case, then I encourage them to back up, be sure that their strengths and their academic major align, and they can take assessments. Students can take assessments at the Career Center on campus and help them. Those assessments will help them hone in on what they're really good at and what they care about. So if a student is really struggling, but they're limited by their academic success skills, or maybe they're not working as hard as they should, I suggest they keep going in that particular line. If, on the other hand, they're working very hard, they've got their academic success skills worked out, they're doing the best job they can have, and they still struggle, then I encourage them to consider a change of major. And again, counselors, advisors that are on campus or in schools are very good at helping students align their skills and their abilities with an academic major, which of course ultimately leads into a career.
Well, I can certainly confirm you can have a decent career without knowing how to do trigonometry.
Exactly.
Again, the name of Dr. Carrie J. Green's new book is Success Skills for High School, College, and Career. You can learn more at carriejgreen.com. At a time when the value of admitting refugees to the United States has come under question, the city of Utica, New York remains widely known for its role in taking in refugees and helping them get an education and a life. Nate Bridge from the New York Reporting Project at Utica College has the story of one family who has made the city its home.
It's an average night for the Regmi family. Kumari is doing the cooking, and her husband Bakash is playing with their one-year-old baby daughter, Aroi. Their apartment is a nice open space for Aroi to play in. The lights are dimmed, and the smell of seasoned vegetables is rising from a pan.
Let's play this one, okay? If you're happy, 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 and you know it, clap your hands.
The Regmis have lived in Utica for 5 years. They lead successful, middle-class lives. He's a nurse practitioner. She's finishing up her master's, about to become a nurse practitioner, too. But their story is not like most. Both of their families are of Nepali heritage, but they lived in the Himalayan country of Bhutan. When the king of Bhutan started expelling anyone who practiced different cultures and traditions, Bakash and Kumari's families were forced out. They became refugees. For the next 17 years, each grew up living in refugee camps on opposite ends of Nepal.
Bhutan, it is a beautiful country when you look. It is a Himalayan country. But it was not beautiful for us. Life in a refugee camp was very difficult. And there was no proper food, and people were very malnourished.
Our houses were made of bamboo and plastic, and if there is a strong wind, we need to secure the plastic, otherwise it would be blown away. But we did not have electricity like how it is here, and we did not have running water.
Bakash recalls the poor conditions of the camp being his original inspiration for becoming a nurse.
And when I was in refugee camp, seeing all those desperate need of poor health, poor condition, I always thought that I wish I could go to the medical school and help these people. But being a refugee, I never had an opportunity to do so.
Kumari also wanted to become a nurse, but lacked the resources growing up. After the U.S. started taking in Bhutanese refugees, Kumari and Bukash's families both resettled in Syracuse in 2009.
The Catholic charity used to help us, like, where to go and to find jobs and stuff. So they told me, dude, you can do a volunteer here because you speak a little bit of English. So I volunteered for, like, 5 months, and Bukash came. And then he started volunteering there. That's where we met.
The two shared an interest in nursing and furthering their education, and they started exploring those options together. They married in 2012 and moved to Utica. For Bukash and Kumari, it's important that their daughter retains their Nepali heritage.
We encourage her to know, like, varieties of languages. At home, we always speak, like, Nepali, and maybe in daycare, they speak English, so maybe she does not understand. And she used to cry every time I drop her off. But now she's getting used to it. She's liking it.
Bukash and Kumari have immersed themselves in the Utica community and as nurse practitioners, educating Central New Yorkers on the importance of blood donations. They organize a blood drive every year. They also work to educate people in Utica about preventing diseases.
I always talk about the primary prevention. Like, it is good to be treated and prevent disease before you get the disease. So not only helping the people, family, and community, I'm helping whole country and I'm saving the budget in the Medicare, and insurance.
While the Regmis have traveled a long road of hardship, they say mutual support has allowed them to build a life together and to use their experiences to help other refugees and the wider community. And while their stories will always be a part of them, they don't call themselves refugees anymore. They go by something else, Americans. I'm Nate Bridge with the New York Reporting Project at Utica College.
Politicians need the media to get their message out, but surprise, they're not always happy about how that message is interpreted. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The stories reporters write and the stories politicians want written are not always the same. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Hans Hissel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College, discusses this statement.
Just about every time we open a newspaper during campaign season, stories about candidates fill the pages. So what goes into those stories? Are the messages in the articles coming directly from the candidate? And is there any difference in the coverage of different types of candidates? I set out to research and answer these questions with the help of one of my students, Zach Stoll. We interviewed journalists from large and small newspapers and sent out a survey to thousands of others. In interviews with political journalists, we found a number of factors influence the coverage candidates receive. Reporters gauge the personnel that surround the candidate and other campaign viability factors to determine if coverage of that candidate is warranted. Reporters also indicated they were influenced by the arc of the national news and its relationship to a candidate's message. For example, if immigration was a hot topic on the national news front, one journalist might decide to cover a candidate whose platform focuses heavily on immigration legislation. We also noticed that bias exists in deciding what candidate's message is to cover. We learned this by studying the messages of candidates and the news coverage of those candidates in 100 randomly selected congressional districts in 2012. We found less congruence between a candidate's message and media coverage in urban districts and for minority candidates. While we are still in the process of understanding why this is, our results suggest that it is not intentional racist discrimination. Rather, journalists think about what their readers would be interested in and what other news is competing for space in the paper. Race is a significant component of American politics, and how people react to race is impacted by what stories journalists decide to cover. This research focuses on democracy, which is about making sure voters are informed and that the message candidates want to communicate to voters is the message voters are receiving.
That was Hans Hissel of Cornell College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.